one of India's most respected communication strategist and image management experts, often called as India's image guru, Dilip Charian. Welcome to India, Russia and the World.
Thank you.
Dilip, you spent decades shaping some of India's biggest political brands. Why has image projection become such a powerful political tool today?
You know, that's a good question in today's times. But when it began, let me assure you that it was rejected. Both corporates as well as politicians had the we-know-it-all attitude to it. And also, it was like a third leg, unwanted and best left out of the frame.
Really?
Yeah. So let me assure you that when I started the business, selling the concept was the job. Today, it's, as you said, really seen as vital. And why is it seen as vital more today than yesterday? Because today, people's attention spans have shrunk to almost nothing. So when you get 5 minutes of my face time or my eyeball time, I need to make the maximum impact. So I need to know what to cut out and I need to know what to focus on. And in the messaging that actually happens in that 5 seconds, you've got to convey what will appeal to you, to him, and to her. And you've got to be able to craft that that messaging in a way which is both compact as well as clear.
Narendra Modi's public image, it's often described as a masterclass in political branding. How much of that image would you say is authentic, real, and how much of it has been crafted over the years?
You know, to start with, he has the instinct of a expert. He knows what works. But behind him, there's always been a system that has trained him, that has put him there, and that has given him the clues as to what will work and what you should say. Okay? Remember, for a politician, it's not just about what will work. It's also what we, the people behind, want you to say. Okay? Now, he has successfully melded both those into who I am. And that, I think, has worked very well. One, because it sounds more real. It's easy. And he doesn't need to rehearse. So, in many senses, Narendra Modi is, as it were, a PR person's wet dream, or it could be a nightmare, because there's almost nothing he doesn't know.
Does a leader's image change depending on the audience? In a sense that, would Narendra Modi's image be projected differently, say, in West Bengal, for the voters of West Bengal, as opposed to, say, for diaspora in the West?
You know, some of the framework stays the same. What does change is the delivery. So Mr. Modi is very keen and loves the act of being able to speak to locals in their language. Honestly, we've seen in study after study that it doesn't make an incremental impact because the impact is already maxed out.
How much of a leader's popularity comes from actual performance versus, say, it comes from communication, branding and perception?
You know, sadly, I would say in today's world, it's an 80-20 in favor of branding.
Branding is 80, really?
So many leaders across the world have survived for very long with low performance metrics and high performance communications. And that is a new thing. You know, in a sense, Runjan, I would say that that is where things have changed. 30 years ago, I think it would have been maybe 50-50. Okay. But it's moved to, I would say, 80-20. I'm exaggerating to make the point. But I would say it's colossally more important than anything else. And that is dangerous because after a while, you see, again, it depends on longevity. If you look at leaders across the world, the longer a leader is in that position, the more image is likely to dominate.
Let's talk about politics of fashion. The Nehru jacket, the Modi kurta, Rahul Gandhi's fitted polo t-shirts. How much does wardrobe shape political identity?
That's a good question. I would say having a uniform is a shortcut. A shortcut to creating an identity which works for you. Now, you've got to be able to define whether that shortcut or that mnemonic, as it were, is something which is crafted for who you want to be seen as, or whether it's something which is a comfort statement. In Rahul Gandhi's case, I think what began as a comfort statement has now become a style statement. In Mr. Modi's case, the Nehru jacket is really the attempt to say that there is a global image of the Indian leader, and I want to conform to that. And I want to then expand beyond that, which is what he has done by playing with it. His kurta and his jacket are no longer just static. They're changing all the time. And there's a dynamic involved in its use, which reflects the place he is and the people who are watching it.
Dilip, we hear the phrase macho politics these days. Is that a real political strategy? And if it is, why does it resonate so much with the voters?
To start with, I think because we've moved into a world where women have actually been marginalized. And despite many attempts of the Women's Reservation Bill, with one excuse or the other, it's been kind of, you know, played down. Macho politics is significant in India because we still remain a rather painfully patriarchal society. So it works very well for India. The other thing is that people are looking for strong leadership.
Yeah.
Equals macho because of the primitive association of strength with being macho. So I think that what has happened is, in India, the macho politician is one who is seen tackling violence on the streets or enemies from across the border. So the symbolism of that has created the space for a macho machine to take over that space and say, I'm the leader because I'm so macho.
The 56-inch kasina, the 56-inch chest, the broad-chested Narendra Modi, that image of him created by the BJP, it's really stuck. What do you think the BJP was trying to sell through that slogan, and why did Indians buy into it?
Indians were looking for change, which Narendra Modi promised. The 56-inch became a kind of, shall we say, a convenient part of the toolkit that the BJP put for itself. It had saffron, it had 56-inch, it had macho leadership, it had a whole bunch of things which you've gone over one after the other. And I think 56-inch featured well because of his predecessor being so unassuming and withdrawn and, in a sense, scrunched up.
The Modi Meloni melody, you know, that became quite iconic, this global social media sensation. What do you think was about the two leaders, their image, that made the moment so viral?
The fact that in India we have such a vast number of troll armies who are unleashed to make any moment memorable by sheer repetition. That is one. The second is that they did have a moment, and that moment was something that was visible and public, and therefore the rhyme worked very well. Modi, Meloni, melody, all of it. Okay?
Yeah.
And Indians are great for this kind of what I would call for poetry. You know, so it worked very well because it rhymed very well. But understand that beneath it, there was a whole machine which was propping it up. Meloni suddenly saw that, and then her machine started to play the same because of the fact that the numbers from India are so impressive yeah. that it always drowns out anything.
And, you know, surprisingly, I would say, Mr. Modi also gave into it. I would assume that a leader like him would not sort of indulge in a moment like that. But, you know, you saw him take that Melody Toffee to Italy with him. And
you know, playing to the, what I would call, the real politic of the real is something that needs to be handled very carefully. He managed to pull it off because it was brief and it was memorable and it was humorous. I always tell people when we work with them on communications that leave humor in the hands of the expert. Leave it at home if you're not guaranteed success. And Mr. Modi is guaranteed success because of the machine that guarantees success.
President Putin and Prime Minister Modi, their car pictures, their car conversations, first in Tianjin and later in Delhi. Those were some unforgettable images. Why do you think those pictures resonated so much, Dilip?
Putin is an example of a macho, machismo leader.
Oh, yeah.
Okay. Now, when that leader chooses a private moment to be made public, i.e. a moment in the car, because that means somebody in the car is taking a picture of you guys. So let's get that straight. Okay. So you know that it's for broadcast. Okay. And it's not often that Mr. Putin would succumb to that kind of a show of, shall we say, bonhomie within, just behind the bonnet. So that's one. So the rarity of that from Mr. Putin's side, and the fact that the blue book, which defines the prime minister's movement, doesn't actually allow him to travel in a car with anybody. So there was a breach of so-called protocol involved, which made the moment far more important. And the third thing is the fact that this was done to prevent bugging of their conversation, that it was a safe space. Okay, so that caught the imagination of a lot of geopolitical players, saying, ah, the car can be swept, it's a confined space, listening to anything inside that wouldn't be possible. So what did they talk? And that curiosity then raises the image to something which you can share even more.
But Dilip, let's talk about President Putin's image. He's seen as somebody who nobody wants to mess with, not even Donald Trump. How do you read that image?
It's the image of someone like Mr. Modi, who's actually been thrown up by a system which is bigger than them. So I'm not saying the FSB, I'm not saying XYZ in the case of Modi, but both of them look like products of a process. That the process has led to you being in the front and the system is behind. But Mr. Trump is not a product of the system, whereas both Mr. Modi and Mr. Putin have been trained by their systems to be elevated to this position. So in that sense, Mr. Putin has the image of a leader who is sure of himself, does not get messed around with, and every 6 months provides evidence of what happens to those who mess around with him. So to that extent, it is demonstrably visible.
How much of President Putin's image comes from his KGB days, his KGB background?
I would say today it may have been reduced to about 50, but it was definitely between 60 and 70 initially, in the initial years. In fact, I think when he stepped off briefly from being, leader and allowed somebody else to take over and then came back in, it was strong just when he returned. But then he managed to put it behind him. He allows it to play center stage less frequently now.
Putin has been often photographed with dogs, a softer, warmer side that contrasts with his strong man image. How do you see it?
You know, if you take the image of Putin, which dominates, it is his moments with horses. And in the human psyche, the horse is a symbol of power.
Yeah.
The dog is a symbol of companionship and softness. So the dog is very often brought in to soften somebody's image. What Mr. Modi does with kids. So his pulling ears of kids and doing those things are what humanizes him, because that is the Indian version of the, you know,
the dog
movement. But I think that in the American election system, kissing kids when you're on the train, on the campaign train, is again another mnemonic that every American president has played to, except Trump.
Russia has a certain image in India that's been shaped for decades by Western books and films. Russian mafia, Russian spies, and so on and so forth. But what about RT? How is RT viewed in India today, given the fact that the West has tried to label it as a propaganda channel? But Indians, I think, know better, don't they?
That's a question which I hadn't thought of. How is RT viewed? RT is viewed as a channel with not too much noise. It's a channel which gives a different perspective. We are now living in a world, and talking of 2026, as opposed to 2020, where noise levels and suspicion levels have risen more than ever before. So people now want to make a judgment on their own. Leave this to me. Just play it the way you want to, but I will take the call. Okay? That's where the smart money is. And the smart minds are seeing that.
Yeah.
So what RT presents, hopefully, is a perspective which is defined as different from what the Fox News and CNN produce. Okay? Does it produce that well? Yes. In many subjects, it gives you greater depth, and it does it with, as I said, with less of the flaunting of quasi-experts and more of what the channel bases its research on. And I think that leads to a higher level of credibility.
Donald Trump, his public commentary, it often comes across as combative, very un-president-like. Do you think this is deliberately portrayed in such a way, or do you think that he just cannot control himself?
As long as he controls the U.S. stock market, where his kids make the most money, he knows what to say. And as long as he's able to achieve that, he doesn't care about the rest of the stuff.
Donald Trump was once widely admired in India, not so much now. Has his brand taken a permanent hit?
Besides the fact that they've named a road after him in Hyderabad, I think he's pretty much at the lowest ebb of his image in India. Does that affect Americans and American trade and American interests? Much less.
Yeah.
Okay. Is Ambassador Gore a good representation of how America is trying to, in a sense, correct the damage? I think he is. You know, he's going to meet Mr. Shah, his message that, you know, the deal is moving ahead, we're working on it, it should be done by next year. America works very well when it plays good cop, bad cop. And I think Donald Trump is very domineering. So he likes to say that this is the deal I want, and I'm going to send out my emissaries to get that deal. I don't care what it takes.
The Iran-US conflict, it's almost ended now. Who do you think has managed a better global image at the end of the day?
In my view, Iran has won this by a long margin. When is the last time you've had any country, forget a world power, and which is what Iran has become, tell the US, take your time. When you're ready with the deal, come and talk to us.
Yeah.
When is the last time you've had an American president sign a peace agreement written in Persian? And when is the last time that a so-called victory deal has been signed in the Palace of Versailles? Okay. So in terms of imagery, the Persian fine art of playing diplomacy according to rules which existed for 3,000 years is probably smarter, and it has played it very well. But the most important thing that has worked for them is the fact that the world was made to believe that the moment we shoot their leader, the country will collapse. The opposite happened.
And their embassies around the world, Iran's embassies around the world, the tweets that they were putting out in response to, say, Donald Trump saying that, you know, if this doesn't happen, the whole civilization will evaporate and so on and so forth, then Iran was so calm and composed, and they would be like, you know what? We can't open the Strait of Hormuz because we've lost the key. Do you think that was unexpected of Iran to behave the way it did?
What was unexpected was that Iran actually outsourced the creative content of this to another agency. Now, that's an agency I'd love to acquire at some point of time. But the fact that a government as conservative, as totalitarian as theirs, is playing with the communication side, allowing professionals to have full liberty to do this, is staggering. To my mind, it probably turned the narrative battle in their favor.
When a crisis hits, there are some leaders we've seen who apologize almost immediately, and then there are some that choose to remain silent. Which is a better strategy?
It depends. What does it depend on? It depends on two things: the nature of the crisis and the character of the leader. Okay. So, for example, if you have a crisis on which you really can't be blamed, then it is very good to go and apologize for it very quickly. So there's been a sad train crash or a plane crash, or, you know, some virus has hit some part of the country. You should be the first one to say, I apologize on behalf of our government. We really should have been more conscious, because there's no way you can be accused. Okay, so apologizing early is good. If there is a steady strand which connects you to that eventuality, then it depends on where your image is. So what we do with many leaders who we work with is that we do almost like you do the tracking of the Brent crude price or the FTSE index or the NSE index. We're tracking it minute to minute. So we know where you are on the wave. And depending on where you are on the wave, you either refuse to, because you're so high up in positive imagery that you don't need to apologize just yet. Hang in there. And in the hanging, you actually rise. We run that kind of a feedback mechanism for some leaders and for some companies, because you need to know when you are in volatile situations, what do you say and when do you say it?
How does media choose its darlings?
Media does not have any choice. Media darlings are bought today. Either they are BOT, bought, or they are BOUGHT, purchased. Mm-hmm. Okay, so media darlings are backroom work. So somebody in the backroom is either paid to, or is given B-rolls, or is given something to incentivize the creation of a darling.
Mm-hmm.
And then you got to do it with at least 3 media outlets to make sure that the darlingness becomes widespread.
Who is Indian media's favorite darling today?
Is there a doubt?
No, you tell me.
I would say there's no darling as darlinged as Mr. Modi. A close second is the real question. Who holds number 2 position?
Who does?
I would say at the moment, it's a toss-up between Rahul Gandhi and Yogi Adityanath. Strangely. So Yogi Adityanath has risen up the ratings, both on account of what's happening and his comments on the Ram Mandir, just as much as Rahul has been able to do that with a whole bunch of other things he's doing and being on point for a whole longer stretch than he normally does.
Number 3.
Vijay, the actor in Tamil Nadu.
Uh-huh.
Hugely popular because of the fact that he genuinely has a following outside Tamil Nadu. He's loved in Kerala. They love him in Telangana. They like him in Karnataka. So
South superstar.
The fact is that he's a superstar with superpowers.
Let's talk geopolitically also now. On the world stage, who would you say are the most popular leaders today?
If you look at popularity on the basis of just the curiosity and the appeal, it's bizarre, but Kim Il Jong would be probably up there because he appears rarely. When he does, he is doing something ridiculous. Okay. And just that, you know, huge Michelin tire kind of blob appearing makes for everybody to look at what he's doing. But more seriously, I think the Pope is up there. The Pope has suddenly got, thanks to attacks by Trump and defense by Meloni, etc., the Pope's visual image and appearance and global. And don't forget, also the Catholic Church in terms of sheer numbers is very large.
Finally, Dilip, what is India's image on the world stage today?
As a dominant power that is the world's probably only growing marketplace. A marketplace that has multiple layers, but even the smallest layer of it is seriously attractive to the world. The world is open for business, and if India stays open for business, our image is only bound to rise.
All right, Dilip Cherian, thank you very much for your time.
Thank you.